exploited masses in the global south. The blood of the Palestinian martyrs and the tears of their children will always remain an eloquent, if tragic, testimony to the utter hypocrisy of Western human rights crusaders and the prevalent unjust world order. Just as apartheid was declared a crime against humanity and a threat to world peace, there cannot be peace in the world with the presence of Zionism. Zionism and the Zionist entity should not be allowed to exist in the community of nations. A window to Palestine.
Soy Daniel Jadwe.
I am Daniel Jadwe, a citizen of Chile, originally from Palestine, born like so many other Palestinians around the world in the diaspora. Chile has one of the largest communities outside the Arab world. It is said that we are close to 300,000, but we are millions spread across the face of the earth, far from our homeland, but committed to the identity, history, and struggle of our people, of our land, which is and will forever be Palestine.
Y será por siempre Palestina.
Hola, amigos y amigas de todo el mundo. Marhaba.
Hello, friends from all over the world. Marhaba. Welcome to this new edition of A Window to Palestine. More than half of Gaza's population is at risk of dying from hunger today, the UN has warned. But we know that this did not start on October the 7th.
We need more help, as has already been said. We are seeing that we may be on the brink of famine in this region. They need supply, they need medical supplies, but the first thing they ask for is food and water. They don't have the most basic things.
Everyone knows that the use of hunger as a weapon of war is a crime against humanity. However, Israel has been using this strategy to fulfill one of the fundamental objectives of this genocide, which is to force the mandatory displacement of more than 2 million Palestinians to usurp the land. They want their land without its inhabitants. Let's see. Let's go deeper. Let's analyze the situation with our correspondent in Gaza, Huda Hijazi.
According to a report released by UNICEF, there are 335,000 children under 5 years of age who live in the Gaza Strip. They are at high risk of severe malnutrition and death as famine increases. In recent weeks, at least 10,000 of them suffer from levels of malnutrition that are threatening their lives. And it is defined as severe wasting, that is a weight well below normal. One of the main causes of this widespread health problem is the small quantity and poor distribution of humanitarian aid that enters the area.
There is little humanitarian aid and little food. There is a man who prepares food for us from time to time and gives each person a spoonful of food. We only ask that they provide us with at least one meal a day. Whatever, lentils, beans, broad beans. We don't order meat. We didn't order lamb. We only ask to be able to feed our children. There are days when we don't eat anything because we depend on the charity of some people. We are starving.
On December 22nd, the UN Security Council approved a resolution for the immediate delivery of more humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip and urgent measures to create the conditions for sustainable cessation of hostilities. However, until now, we haven't noticed any increase in the average number of humanitarian aid trucks entering the Strip. It is about 100 trucks a day, which does not cover even 10% of Gaza's needs.
The aid is not enough, since we are talking about a town of 2.3 million people. Before, about 500 trucks entered daily. These days, between 20 and 30 trucks are entering. How are they going to supply all these people? Everything is insufficient and cannot supply this population.
The aid that enters Gaza is collected by UNRWA, the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, so that it is responsible for distributing the aid among the evacuees. However, this aid, which is insufficient, is not distributed equally, and the majority is distributed only to people who are in the schools or refugee camps of this organization. Likewise, more than 60% of the evacuees are in places outside the UNRWA control perimeter and do not receive this help.
We have only received one piece of humanitarian aid in the 20 days we've been here, and it only consists of canned food and stale bread. When we go to ask for help, they tell us that we should receive it from the mosque. We even have to buy water with our money. We can't find food. We eat a can of beans all day. My children ask me to eat chicken or meat, but I can't buy it. We can't even buy lentils. Help comes in every day. But where does this aid go if we do not receive it? We have not received help for more than 15 days. Just nothing.
Most Gazans are no longer seeking humanitarian aid, but rather an end to the war so they can return to their homes and live in dignity. They assure that they are tired of having to be under Israeli occupation and affirm that they are willing to resist until they achieve their freedom and put an end to the crimes committed by this hated regime against the Palestinian population.
My message is that I hope the war is over and people can return to their homes. We don't want help. We want each person to return home and be reunited with their family. There are many families that are separated and are losing many of their members, so we don't think mainly about aid, but rather we think about returning to our lands and to Gaza.
85% of an approximate 1.9 million displaced people take refuge in places like Rafah. We must highlight that not even the places designated by Israel have escaped the indiscriminate bombings. According to the UN, Gaza has reached a more critical level of humanitarian catastrophe due to famine. Hunger should never be used as a weapon of war, since it is collective punishment that, in addition to leading to death, causes severe physical and psychological deterioration for everyone, but especially children. Hoda Hejazi, Gaza, Palestine.
The humanitarian crisis that Israel is causing through these actions of ethnic cleansing, support for illegal settlers who daily practice terrorism against the Palestinian population, and the significant decrease in the possibility of receiving humanitarian aid is only one part of the policy of physical and political extermination of the Palestinian people. This is under the complicit eyes and also under the unconditional support of both Europe and the United States, which not only have decided to keep silent, but also finance the genocide through countless aid. This is while there is a total absence of humanitarian aid to the Palestinian people today. We thank Hoda for this interesting report from the epicenter of this crisis, and in the next part of the program, we will talk a little more about the strategy of destruction of the Palestinian economy that has been taking place for several decades. This is another means that complies with the dreams of ethnic cleansing of all Palestinian people. Israel has been using this strategy for more than 75 years in order to usurp all of Palestine.
We
are back, and in this part, I want to invite you to a conversation with an international analyst, writer and journalist, specialist, and a regular contributor to critical thought and left-wing theory, not only in the Basque country, but also in Latin America and in the Middle East, with particular knowledge of the Palestinian case. Now let's visit our dear guest, Professor Iñaki Gil from San Vicente.
Buenos días, Iñaki. Muchas gracias por esta
Good morning, Iñaki. Thank you very much for accepting this invitation. I want to start by asking this question. Before the October 7th of last year, how had Israel made Palestine agonize over its economy, especially in Gaza, and how had it strangled its economy?
In particular, la de Gaza.
Well, basically, it had been doing it through four levels, four practices that, although they changed from time to time, depending on the circumstances, remained as such since 1948, even before, when the disposition of lands, the disposition of habitations, houses, homes, the disposition of orchards, the disposition of water, etc. This was the first and remains the first. And what it did meant that Palestine did not have the capacity to maintain agricultural production. But it was a lie. Palestine, due to its weather and soil condition, was very good and had a very good production of cereals, fruits, and olives, especially olives. This is economy. The second strategy is the very removal of the Palestinian youth and workforce, not only on the agricultural level, but over the years on the cultural level. We have seen here in Europe, we have seen many Palestinian workers, for example, in health section, Palestinian immigrants who didn't have the chance to work in Palestine, although they had been trained in the universities of countries like Russia, like Cuba, like the USSR originally, then Cuba, etc. But they didn't want to work for Israel, so they had to immigrate. They could not work in the Zionist regime and had to immigrate. This was the second looting, or let's say intellectual looting. Now I tell you how this benefits the Zionist regime. It benefits them indirectly, because when these sophisticated scientific immigrants sent economic remittances to Palestine, Israel levies taxes on these remittances and enriches its economy. The third strategy is a more sophisticated one, which is to control the arrival of technology. The arrival of technology even after Gaza officially existed and the West Bank officially existed. The arrival of industrial technology was controlled by the Zionist regime, and it let pass what it is interested in and avoid any technology not in its benefit. This affects agriculture, right? And how did it do it? They did it basically with the internal collaboration of the Palestinian bourgeoisie, the bourgeoisie or the middle bourgeoisie, which collaborated with the Israeli regime and had to pay taxes. Both the Palestinian Authority, which is a servile authority with respect to imperialism, as well as the Palestinian small and medium bourgeoisie, totally corrupt, and the Zionist regime derived huge benefits from this, which did not benefit the Palestinian people. This has effectively created a subsistence economy in Palestine with an appropriate capacity, because it has a very industrial people that studies a lot, prepares a lot, and educates itself a lot, but cannot develop everything based on its learnings and research.
Thank you very much, Iñaki. We are going to give the audience the opportunity to ask you two questions to continue delving deeper into this topic.
Good afternoon, Professor. My name's Jessica Romero, health designer, architecture student. My question is, what are the economic interests in Israel's current war against Gaza?
In 2000, a large amount of gas was discovered on the coast. Of that large amount of gas, approximately a little more than 60% corresponds to the territory of Gaza. And internationally, it is Gazan gas, gas of the Palestinian people. This is one of the things that Israel wants to keep. What about Palestine? Well, Israel seeks to expand its settlements throughout the land with the aim of expanding the production it needs. Israel, for example, barely manages to produce olives, olive oil. Practically, it loots everything Palestine has, and it buys them, but at very cheap prices. And that's because of over-exploitation. Then there is another third very important factor for the future, which is fishing. The Zionist regime is doing everything possible to annul the right and practice of fishing by the Gazan people, because they have fertile coasts with abundant fish. Israel is very interested in their coasts, and it cannot plunder. So what do? They simply bomb the fishing boats. This way, they cause hunger, and they hope that when they usurp Gaza,
Gaza, or bring in an authority even more servile than the one that exists in the West Bank, they will win everything. And then there is another factor as well, apart from the control, let's say, of the industries that exist in the Gaza Strip, and it is the problem of tourism. Israel is pursuing a very strong tourism promotion policy. And the coast of Gaza, of the Gaza Strip, is a coast especially suitable for tourism because of the waters, the heat, the beauty it has, etc. It's for direct economic reasons. Here, I mention some other factors. What about the military industry, and above all, the information industry, the espionage industry, the terrorism industry, and the industry of counterinsurgency, which exists in our America and has caused numerous problems, and also here in Yuzkal Haria? This depends on two issues. It depends on imperialist technology, not only Zionist, but also European, North American, because they all are merged into a single business. Second, it also depends on the existence of a market, and that market needs guarantees that Israel is a sufficiently established, tough, and solid power capable of maintaining its economic, research, and technological development. That's why the confrontation against the Palestinian people is very strong. They need to crush the Palestinian people. Now, here's the question. To whom is Zionism going to sell this supposed invincible superiority at the level of technology of counterinsurgency, occupation, repression, extermination, infiltration, etc., while they themselves have been incapable of foreseeing, preparing for, and responding to this defensive action of the Palestinian people? That is a serious blow to the counterinsurgency market.
Professor, I'm Francisco Lera, an economist, and I wanted to ask you, after your interesting explanation, what are the repercussions of what is happening in Palestine on the world economy?
As the current world panorama is, Palestine is a place of connection of two great axes, two great historical axes, historical in the development of human evolution itself, the great step of anthropology from Africa to Asia and Europe, and then it has been the axis that has connected the Silk Road with the route practically from south to north, which allowed Africa to reach Asia, Russia, Europe. Caravans brought in a quantity of gold, slaves, ivory, African species, African products. This was practically in progress until the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, or before also, until, let's say, the entire Atlantic axis was developed, and with the Mediterranean axis already collapsed. This is because the ascendant capitalism since the 16th century pillaged the Atlantic axis and pillaged our America and what was the Mediterranean axis, the Ottoman Empire that connected with China, etc. All of that was gradually going into decline. Well, that's history. But in the present, those two axes remain, and one of them is taking on special socioeconomic importance, and the other one is taking on not only socioeconomic importance, but also military importance. And I'm going to explain myself. For two very simple reasons, pay attention to the axes of development. The Middle East occupies the place, as it did before, and that is why I refer to anthropogeny. The Middle East occupies the place of connection of the eastern zone of Eurasia, well, practically even of the central zone of Eurasia, from China, half of Russia, etc., Iran, and that entire area of India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, all of that. It is a very, very important axis of land in terms of the geographic development of connections. This becomes clearer following 2013 with the Silk Road projects, the large railway projects, etc. There may be a maritime connection that has also been studied, but it is unsure, and it cannot guarantee it. It cannot cope with the enormous amount of products that are thought to arrive from Eurasia to Africa, from Africa to Eurasia. All of this would pass through the Middle East, and that Middle East could then diversify towards the West. It could diversify towards Greece, part of Turkey, but from Greece it could diversify towards Europe. To Europe, well, in Romania, to Germany, Hungary, Poland, and from there directly to Italy, etc., etc. There are studies, and that geographical axis is vital. The geographic axis is vital simply in the projection of a fundamental part of what is called the BRICS, and what is called multipolarity. This is what these international forces want. It is precisely what they want: a fast, safe land transportation network that would operate 24 hours a day. This would be guaranteed by the control of the Indian Sea, the Indian Ocean, what is called the entire Indo-Pacific area. Today, at this moment, the logical and necessary and just resistance of the Yemeni people has caused a serious problem for imperialism and the Western economy and for the Zionist economy itself, with the practical paralysis of the port of Haifa. That's good. That strategic point is clear. Then there is another point that is also strategic for practically the entire world, but above all for the United States and Europe. Because the two straits that connect the Middle East and serve as the central point of Middle East with Eurasia and Africa, plus the Suez Canal, plus the canal that Israel wants to build now, the Ben-Gurion Canal, it would be one of the sites along the Strait of Malacca, which is in Asia, right next to the Strait of Panama, and hopefully the Strait of Nicaragua can be built, which is one of the reasons why imperialism wants to destroy the Sandinista front. That is because Nicaragua Canal can break the North American monopoly from top to bottom and ride along with other straits such as Gibraltar, Escatahat, and those of Denmark. That fundamental nucleus together with those straits is the fundamental nucleus of maritime logistics. But maritime logistics also has a military side, and that is why the danger that threatens the economy and power of the West arises once again. When I say economy, I insist that it is not limited to just the material sense of the term of factories, agricultural products, raw materials, but also their planned economy for the next 15, 20, 30 years. That's what I'm referring to, in its connection with science and above all, the situation with the military forces. Well, for the U.S. and for Europe, it is vital to control the entire axis that goes from the Atlantic coast of the United States, which passes through the Azores Islands, which reaches the Canary Islands, which passes through the Strait of Gibraltar, which is between the Iberian Peninsula and Morocco, and which runs through the Mediterranean and reaches the Middle East. About the Middle East, I should mention that because the projects that they had planned, although I believe they are going down, it will go directly to the ocean, to the Indo-Pacific zone, which is a recent name imposed by the Pentagon precisely. This axis will go to the Indo-Pacific zone, and from there all the way to the east, until practically it reaches South Korea, passing through India, South Korea, Japan, the Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, Australia, etc. And all this for what? To achieve absolute control. Absolute control of China, Afghanistan, Turkey, India, and then Russia upwards. Well, this central axis is strategic, and for that reason, they need to dominate the Middle East.
Muchas gracias, profesor, por haber aceptado esta...
Thank you very much, Professor, for having accepted this debate. We're going to take a short break, and in the next section, we continue talking with the Palestinian diaspora in Chile.
Con la diáspora palestina de Chile.
Dear listeners, that was the first part of A Window to Palestine. You can listen to the second part tomorrow.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remembered the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears." ¶¶
the limelight.
The World Court has unanimously ordered the Israeli regime to take all necessary and effective action to ensure basic food supplies to Gaza's Palestinian population and halt spreading famine in the enclave. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered the story and tells us more. The World Court on Thursday, 28th of March, unanimously ordered the Israeli regime, accused by South Africa of genocide in Gaza, to take all necessary and effective action to ensure basic food supplies to Gaza's Palestinian population and halting of spreading famine in the enclave. However, the resistance movement Hamas says a ceasefire is needed to halt the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. The order from the International Court of Justice came as the Israeli military and Palestinian resistance fighters battled in close combat around Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital, where the armed wings of the Palestinian resistance groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad said they attacked Israeli soldiers and tanks with rockets and mortar fire. Judges at the International Court of Justice, the World Court, said the people in the coastal enclave face worsening conditions. The World Court observes that Palestinians in Gaza are no longer facing only a risk of famine, but that famine is setting in Gaza, the judges said in their order. The new measures were requested by South Africa as part of its case that accuses the Israeli regime of state-led genocide in Gaza. Senior Hamas official Bassem Naim said the ruling did not go far enough and the Israeli regime must be ordered to end its military offensive in Gaza to halt the suffering in the enclave. We welcome any new demands to end this humanitarian tragedy in Gaza and especially in northern Gaza Strip, but we hope the court orders a ceasefire as an absolute solution to all the miseries our people in Gaza are living through, Bassem Naim told Reuters news agency. The United Nations Security Council voted on Tuesday, 26th of March, to demand an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The United States of America abstained from the vote but did not veto it. Iran's Press TV has also covered this story and tells us more. The United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says the catastrophic humanitarian situation in Gaza is man-made and has criticized the Israeli regime's lack of cooperation with the International Court of Justice regarding the facilitation of aid deliveries into the besieged Palestinian territory. The head of the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, Philip Lazzarini, made the statement in a post on X on Friday, 29th of March, after the International Court of Justice issued a legally binding order calling on the Israeli regime to ensure without delay that humanitarian aid is provided to the Gaza Strip to halt famine. The renewed binding order from the International Court of Justice is a stark reminder that the catastrophic humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip is man-made and it's worsening. It can, however, still be reversed, according to UNRWA's head, Philip Lazzarini. Lazzarini said the order calls on the Israeli regime to cooperate with the United Nations to facilitate the delivery of urgently needed humanitarian aid to Gaza. Cooperation means that Israel must reverse its decision and allow UNRWA to reach northern Gaza with food and nutrition convoys on a daily basis and to open additional land crossings into Gaza. Reiterating that the humanitarian situation in Gaza is deteriorating, UNRWA's chief Philip Lazzarini called for more pressure on Israel to stop its months-long aggression against the Palestinian territory. The conditions of over 2 million Palestinians are worsening. Gaza is becoming an impossible place for a dignified life. In under 6 months, where people did not know hunger and were largely healthy, famine thresholds are unprecedented in time and speed. Member states should exert more pressure to implement the order by the International Court of Justice. Those who stopped funding UNRWA should reconsider their decision to allow the agency to fulfill its mandate, including help averting famine in Gaza. The United Nations and other aid agencies have warned of imminent famine due to Israel's prevention of land-based delivery of life-saving aid to the population of Gaza. Meanwhile, the spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry, Nasser Kanani, says the crimes of the Israeli regime against the Palestinians of Gaza over the past 6 months served as a yardstick for assessing the adherence of governments to human rights principles. In a post on his official X account on Friday, 29th of March, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the painful tragedy in the besieged territory has tested the commitment of countries and institutions as well as world bodies to their human, moral, legal and international responsibilities towards human rights. Nasser Kanani also commented on the reaction of those countries who claim to champion human rights to the terrible crimes that the Israeli regime is committing in Gaza, the killing and burying of two unarmed Palestinian youths in Gaza. Kanani said, "It clearly shows how sincere they are in their human rights slogans and claims." The post on X by the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman came after a new video showed Israeli soldiers have shot dead two unarmed Palestinian men in cold blood while they were trying to return to northern Gaza Strip, their bodies buried in sand and rubbish by an Israeli army bulldozer. The disturbing incident, which was captured by long-distance cameras, shows Israeli soldiers opening fire on the two men who were walking along the Al-Rashid Street and the Al-Nablusi roundabout in Gaza City. At least one of the two men repeatedly waved what appeared to be a white flag in a sign of surrender and to show that there was no threat. In a statement on Thursday, 28th of March, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said, "Video footage aired by Al Jazeera television documenting the cold-blooded killing of two unarmed young civilians by Zionist occupation forces and their bodies dragged with a bulldozer to cover up the crime is further evidence of Zionist crimes in Gaza." Hamas called on the International Criminal Court, the ICC, to take urgent action to stop the systematic killing of Palestinians in Gaza. And for the sixth night in a row, thousands of Jordanians have been demonstrating near the Israeli embassy in Amman to voice their support for Palestinians of Gaza. The demonstrators gathered in front of the Israeli embassy in Amman on Friday, 29th of March, calling on the Jordanian government to cancel its highly unpopular peace treaty with Israel and end all its other agreements with the occupying Zionist regime. Protesters slammed the latest Israeli crimes in Gaza, in particular the attacks on Gaza's hospitals. They expressed their support for Palestinian resistance groups and reiterated their demand for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. They also called on the Jordanian government to cancel its peace treaty with the Israeli regime and close the regime's embassy in Jordan. Jordan signed a peace treaty with Israel in 1994. Amid efforts at the time by the United States to work out a so-called two-state solution to the Palestinian conflict.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in Hope.
Toward the Pig.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station. It's Youth Station for you. I'm your humble co-host, Muzaffar Haider.
And I am Asma.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
What age is appropriate for death? That is the question that we are going to be discussing today.
Yeah.
What age would you like to die, Sister?
The Asla? Sooner the better.
The sooner the better. I knew you were going to say that. I feel like that sometimes as well. That is what studying English literature does to you guys. It makes you want to die as soon as possible. I felt like that before until I really studied and looked at what death actually is. It's really mm-hmm. terrifying if we haven't detached ourselves from our souls.
And now God is there and He's so kind, so He won't let me alone in that journey.
God, that's so true. Man, yeah, I want to die too. I can't wait. Like, it's going to be so cool. It's Peter Pan, he says.
Whatever it is, I know that death is very difficult. I know that means you have to put everything behind, like all the emotional strings you have with your dear ones. You have to just break them, as in temporarily, of course. Yeah. And then you have to forget about all the dreams you have. The journey is very difficult, but still, whenever I think of the kindness of Allah and how much He loves me, then I would make sure that He's not going to leave me alone in that journey. The other world is going to be a better place than this world, in which we have too much of traumas, miseries, wars, children are getting killed. People are dying, and I'm just sitting doing nothing.
Okay. Wait, you've given me too many things to say on that. Okay, look. First of all, the Holy Quran says, "Ya ayyuhal insan, O human beings, innaka kadihun ila rabbika kadham famulaqi. Surely you are striving, hard striving, and you are certainly going to meet Him."
Mm-hmm.
Right. So at the end of all this struggle and turmoil and chaos that we're having to face here, we are eventually going to meet our Lord. And it is a beautiful thing.
Of course.
In one sense. The other thing is, Imam Ali alayhi salam was asked, would you prefer to worship Allah in this world or in Jannah? What do you think he said?
In this world, of course.
Why?
Because out of these difficulties comes the beauty of your worship.
Ahsantum. So he actually said, because when I worship my Lord in Jannah, I am pleased with Him.
Yeah.
But when I worship my Lord in this world, He is pleased with me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's so beautiful. Also, sister, also, there is a hadith very profound. He says, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, I would prefer to die having lived a long life. I don't want to die when I'm a young child, because then I want to understand my Lord before I go to meet Him.
Mm-hmm.
This journey of life is all about understanding, like gaining that understanding of Allah before we go to meet Him in the hereafter, inshallah. So, I mean, we're not supposed to want to die, sister, is my point.
Of course, of course.
This is a golden opportunity.
Yeah, I was just pouring my heart out to you guys.
I know, I feel the same. I feel exactly the same.
But I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who are listening to us who would have the same idea. Like, death in a younger age is pretty much better than death in an old age. When you are so unable and so weak and so feeble and you're dependent on other people.
That's what I was going to say about Peter Pan. You know about Peter Pan, right? He goes, the pirates threaten him and they say, we're going to kill you. And he says, to die would be a great adventure. And he stays young forever. anyway, I don't like Peter Pan.
There's a novel. The Persian translation of book is literally as in Hamimi Mirand, like everybody's going to die.
Okay.
Everybody will eventually die. What happens in this book is that there is a person who cannot die. Like he's been living for too many centuries and he cannot die. There is no way out of death. When you read this book, as you come to the ending of this book, actually, this starts from the very beginning. You would come to realize that death is a blessing. Okay. And if there was no death in life, then life would have been an eternal torture.
What? There was this group of people, they prayed to Allah, and they say, oh Allah, take away death from us.
Mm-hmm.
So the prophet of their time, he prays, and Allah takes away death from them.
And they got old,
they
I guess.
Older and, older and older and older. And then it got to a point where a person was looking after their children and their parents and their parents' parents and their parents' parents and their grandparents and their great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents. And they were they said, oh Allah, please give us death back. Mm-hmm. This is unbearable.
Yeah. So it's a blessing. By mentioning that book, all I wanted to say is that, yes, true, we should not pray for death because that's not what Ahlul Bayt has taught us and because that's not what God wants from us, because life is supposed to be a nice journey, a nice opportunity for you to flourish. But then at the same time, we as ordinary common human beings, we would come to this point that we take it as maybe easy and common as we could understand it. Like sometimes death is a turning point in your life, like what happens in many stories.
Like death, somebody else dying, you mean?
What?
Like somebody else dying is a turning point?
No. My own death. Okay. I'm not talking about anybody because other people's death is going to be a suffering to me.
Right.
It's not going to be a turning point. But in our lives, as just the examples that you gave, and in this book, if you go through it, you would understand that sometimes death is a blessing. Well, let's go for a short break and then we'd be back.
To get even more negative. Welcome back, guys. If you're still there, we're talking about death.
Such a nice topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So many of the people out there are probably listening to us and they're going, no, it's just you two. You two are the only ones who feel this way. I like my life. No, astaghfirullah. No, we're not.
And you know, that's because of too much of attachment. When I was younger, I was afraid of death. So much afraid of death. And then, actually I was a child back in time. So, and then I grew much more into this much more mature version of myself. And I came to realize that the more of attachments you have into this world, the more you're going to be scared of death.
Yeah.
But the more you prepare yourself for the other world, the more you watch every single step you take in this world, then you're going to be more prepared for it. Like you're not going to take it as a negative thing. It's going to be a new life. It's a new sparkle. And a new one, which is so much more beautiful than the one we had.
Stop it, sister. You're going to make me cry. I can't wait.
No, astaghfirullah. You know what we can ask for is a good death.
Mm-hmm.
A good death.
Exactly.
That's what's really important. Yeah. Well, they often pray for akhibat bekhair, right?
Exactly.
To have a good outcome of your life. Make it all mm-hmm. be something worth it.
To end it beautifully.
End it beautifully, yeah. That
with honor.
Every novel that you read, you know, the ending is so important. Mm-hmm. And when the ending is a downer, you're just like, oh, you kind of forget the entire story.
I hate it when they leave it open.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, then, inshallah, I pray that yours is not open, you know?
Of course it's not open.
You get closure.
Of course it is not open. For us, it has an absolute enclosure.
Yeah, in the hereafter, though. Not yes. When you die, your death might be completely unexpected, you know, it might be really shocking.
Yeah,
you might
right.
be walking down
For example, like if I just crossed this door and then I died.
People die in all sorts of weird ways.
Yeah.
Have you seen it? There's a series we used to watch in England. It was called Horrible Histories.
No,
oh, come on, you got to watch Horrible Histories. Just type in Horrible Histories.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about different things that actually happened in history, or at least they have records
nice.
Of them. And they're presented for children, like in a really funny, comedic, childish yeah. way. And there's one skit that they
Thank
had
you
on
for
there.
Suggestion.
No, it's really cool, though. I could still watch it. There's mm-hmm. one called Stupid Deaths. And it has a guy dressed up like the Angel of Death.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a whole line of people who are queuing up historical figures who died in really stupid ways. Yeah, loads of people have died in really stupid ways.
Yeah, a lot of people.
And God protect us from a death like that.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
We cannot wish for death, but we can wish for an honorable death.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to be old. Old age is really, really scary. Your bones start aching. You know, one of the scariest things about it is you're going to see the generation after you picking up new slang and technology that you don't understand. And you start to see them doing things that, you know.
The fact that you feel you do not fit the time is so horrible.
Well, your friends are going to be dead.
Yeah.
Your parents and your whole... Like,
everybody's gone
and uncle,
you're the only one who's
nobody,
out there.
Let me tell you something really scary. One day, mm-hmm. somebody is going to remember your name for the last time.
Yeah.
And after that, nobody's going to remember you again.
Well, let's hope it's not like that. Let's hope that our name is going to be there forever.
Why would it be there forever? Can you...
You do something good... Like
yeah, I mean,
you
if we
write
do something,
something
worthy.
Good, like you contribute something to this world, which is going to be so phenomenal.
But if you do something too good, they'll end up deifying you, and that's even worse. Corona times, suicide increased a lot.
Oh, yeah, because everybody was isolated in their homes.
Yeah,
so.
Everybody was just like thinking.
Or they were just facing the true reality of life.
And human beings, people really mm-hmm. revealed themselves. How
like,
weird
they as
are.
In life, you are a loner. Like, actually, for those people who do not believe in God,
mm-hmm.
like in real life, you are a lonely traveler who's just wandering around so lonely.
It's really scary.
Yeah. But when you have God and you have a connection and a spiritual bond, then. No matter how lonely you are sure that there is someone who is always there and whose protection and support is coming from nowhere that you could think of.
Yeah, subhanAllah. But that still makes death seem appealing, to be honest, because like, then you can cut out everybody else.
Yeah.
Know? I think, who was it? Some thinker, he said that death is other people.
Yeah,
that?
Yeah.
Who is that?
I have heard that quote, but I don't remember
yeah.
who is it from. Just, death is other people.
Yeah. I mean, if you could just be completely alone.
Or maybe
you know.
Hell is, maybe this world is other planets' hell. So I guess this was all. There is no ending to this topic because it's so interesting and fascinating.
If we survive, we will see you next time, inshallah.
Inshallah, yes. More. Let's hope so. This was all. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you, brother, and thank you, dear listeners. Until another time, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that, inshallah, in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Allah, Allah. Allah, Allah. Allah, Allah, Allah.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us, the Ahlul Bayt, and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell."
In the limelight.
In Britain, Professor Pat Cullen, the Royal College of Nursing's Chief Executive and General Secretary, has said it is deeply worrying to see more and more overseas nurses choosing to leave the United Kingdom. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Almost 9,000 foreign nurses a year are leaving the United Kingdom to work abroad amid a sudden surge in nurses quitting the already understaffed National Health Service for better-paid jobs elsewhere. The rise in nurses originally from outside of the European Union moving to take up new posts abroad has prompted concerns that Britain is increasingly becoming a staging post in their careers.
The number of UK-registered nurses moving to other countries doubled in just 1 year, between 2021-2022 and 2022-2023, to a record 12,400 cases, and has soared fourfold since before the coronavirus pandemic. 7 out of 10 of those leaving last year, or 8,680 individuals, qualified as a nurse somewhere other than the United Kingdom or the European Union, often in India or the Philippines. According to research from the Health Foundation, many had worked in Britain for up to 3 years. The vast majority of those quitting are heading to the United States, to New Zealand or Australia, where nurses are paid much more than in Britain, sometimes up to almost double pay. Experts have voiced their alarm about the findings and said the National Health Service across the United Kingdom, already struggling with about 40,000 vacancies for nurses and hugely reliant on those coming from abroad, is increasingly losing out in the global recruitment race. Dame Anne Marie Rafferty, a professor of nursing studies at King's College London, said, "It feels like the National Health Service is falling down the league table as a destination of choice for overseas nurses." She added, "Worryingly, it feels as if Britain is perceived not as a high but middle-income country in pay terms and as a staging post where nurses from overseas can acclimatise to Western-type health systems in the search for better pay and better working conditions." The Health Foundation report shows last year 12,400 nurses working in the United Kingdom applied for a Certificate of Current Professional Status, or CCPS, which they need to have to move to work in another country. The think tank said the largest increase among that group was in overseas trained nurses who had only worked in the United Kingdom for 3 years or less. That pronounced trend in short stays suggests that for many recruits from abroad, the United Kingdom may be simply a stepping stone prior to moving to other destinations. It pointed out that the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, data showed that while a nurse in the United Kingdom earned an average of $46,000 a year, substantially less than in Australia, $71,000 a year. Also less than New Zealand, $57,000 a year, and the United States, with $84,900 a year. Application for a Certificate of Current Professional Status, CCPS, to work in America rose tenfold between 2021-2022 and 2022-2023, after a change in its visa policy meant many more foreign nurses were able to move to the United States. The Royal College of Nursing said the growing exodus of overseas-trained nurses was due to the significant erosion in pay the nursing profession has suffered in Britain since 2010. Professor Pat Cullen, the Royal College of Nurses Chief Executive and General Secretary, said, "It is deeply worrying to see more and more overseas nurses choosing to leave Britain. The recruitment of domestic nurses is collapsing and services are gripped by workforce shortages. With patient needs already going unmet, the prospect of losing more of our international colleagues doesn't bear thinking about." Pat Cullen added, "The reality is that sustained attacks on pay and poor working conditions are leaving the UK's healthcare services unable to compete on the world stage. International nurses, like all nurses, have every right to choose to work in countries that better value their skills and expertise. It's no joke that nursing pay in the United Kingdom is joint bottom of 35 OECD countries." The report's co-author, Elaine Kelly, the assistant director at the Health Foundation's Research Centre, said that
with an acute nursing shortage and so many overseas nurses quitting the United Kingdom, if the National Health Service is to avoid becoming a stepping stone to careers elsewhere, it needs to be a more attractive place to work for all nurses, regardless of where they were trained. Elaine Kelly added, "The brain drain was especially worrying because it cost the National Health Service about £10,000 to replace each foreign recruit who then moved elsewhere." The Department of Health and Social Care said it did not recognize the Health Foundation's figures. A spokesperson said the latest nursing